Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind. Hey everybody, and welcome to Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind, the show where we replay or re-air some of our favorite segments and interviews we did in the past because some things deserve a listen to more than once. I'm your host, Kyle Filson, and on today's show, we're going all the way back to April 21st, 2014, when we spoke to researcher, author, and podcaster Christopher O'Brien. Since 1992, Christopher O'Brien has investigated over 1,000 paranormal events reported in the San Luis Valley. Now, if you're not familiar with that, that's located in south central Colorado and north central New Mexico. And while working with law enforcement officials, ex-military ranchers, and an extensive network of skywatchers from 1992 to 2002, and even up to this day, he's documented one of the most intense waves of unexplained activity ever reported from a single geographic region of North America. Now, during his 10-year investigation, it resulted in and produced, he was able to produce four books in his mysterious valley. It was a trilogy at one time, but now there's an extra book. Now, these books are pretty cool. They are called The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, and my favorite, Stalking the Herd. Now, his meticulous field investigation of UFO reports, unexplained livestock deaths, Native American legends, cryptozoology, and secret military activity, and the folklore in the area is led him to produce these books. It's really interesting. If you're fascinated by cattle mutilations and stuff like that, I suggest you pick these books up. I will put links to them in the show notes, but you can just Google it or you can go on Amazon, search up those titles, and you'll find them. But without further ado, let's get into that interview with Chris.
All right, folks, we have got a treat today. We are joined on air by the king of the cattle mutilation stories, Mr. Christopher O'Brien. Chris, how are you doing, my friend?
Oh, man, I've been trying to get this dead cow off from around my neck for years, and now I'm the king?
The king.
There's no hope.
The cover art of the book is awesome, so there's really no shaking that. There's no shaking it now.
Thank you. Yeah, I was really proud of that cover. I design all my covers. Actually, the last three books I've designed, and that one I had some help from a graphic artist for some of the typeface stuff. But I just had that image of that calf hovering in the air with nature coming down and grabbing it, and then a helicopter hovering ominously above it.
You can see the fear in the calf's eyes.
Actually, I stole that picture from a photograph of a cow sliding on the pavement, running down the streets of Pamplona in Spain during the run of the bulls.
It's perfect. I mean, the cover art, that's what me and Kyle always check. You know, that's the first thing that draws you into the books. And you see the cover art, like, that's an awesome cover.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. From your mouth to Amazon's minions.
That's everybody, if nothing else, you got to grab the book. First of all, it's not really a book. It's more of a tome. You have dumped your life into this book, Chris. This 600-page monster of so much information that if anybody – let me start off by saying I hate the term mutilation. I've always hated that term.
Thank you.
Because it's – it's not. It's just something that you can't really, I don't really know if there is a name to really pinpoint to put on it. But for a lack of a better term right now, we'll have to use mutilation. But for anybody that's into this and really is blown away by it, this is the book to read. Now, I was introduced to the first theories of it when I was younger by Gabe Valdez and some of his work when I first heard it. And then it's kind of grown from there to where now you've written a series of books that talks about the strangest stuff, and it's something that Kyle and I really relate to because it's not that really that far from us, and we've been through this area a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, when I first got involved, innocently enough, actually, as just a small-town newspaper reporter, when I first got involved in researching this subject, I was immediately smacked upside the head, and I knew that there were no one size fits all answers to explain any of this, whether it's crypto creatures, UFOs, unexplained livestock deaths or animal deaths, ghosts, hauntings, poltergeist stuff, near-death experiences, abductions. I mean, you can go down the list of cultural memes that really have no one size fits all answer. And in my estimation, the granddaddy Gordian knot riddle of them all is the so-called cattle mutilation mystery. This is so complex. There is so much involved here that goes back thousands of years in our relationship with livestock, how we worship the cow and bull simultaneously, equally, for several thousand years, and then how that worship, the bull worship, went to the West, and the cow worship went to the East and ended up in India. And then marching forward through time, looking at our what used to be a sacred relationship with livestock, which is now a very unceremonious relationship with livestock. And in one single super rendering plant, we can process 400 animals an hour. 80% of the antibiotics that we use in this country go into cattle to stop them from getting sick from wading around in a foot of feces and urine in these huge, massive feedlots. We pump them full of 1,700 pounds of grain, which are not really, their systems aren't developed to metabolize grain properly. They should be eating grass, so we pump them full of grain. Pump them full of growth hormones to get them as fat as possible, as quickly as possible, so we can get them out of these unsanitary conditions. The average person knew what it took for that little calf being born to end up on their, in their supermarket on a piece of styrofoam wrapped in plastic. There'll be a lot less people eating meat. Now, I'm not a vegetarian. I love meat. I love wild game. I love bison. I do eat beef, but only beef where I know where it comes from and the conditions that the animal was raised and rendered and processed. I eat dairy, sparingly, knowing where it comes from. I'm very careful because a lot of the book really boils down to environmental and health concerns as it relates to cattle on the planet. There are 1.37 billion head of cattle on this planet. They are arrayed through over 940 different breeds. And what blew my mind early on researching cattle in our relationship with them is that they've determined through a genetic study that all the cattle on the planet are derived from a single herd of 80 animals that were domesticated in northern Iran 10,500 years ago.
That is a mind-blowing fact.
Right, it's amazing.
80 cattle. I don't think people realize, too, just how hard they are on the environment as far as pollutants from cattle. Being here,
you want me to
always
go
around,
the list?
Yeah, being always around ranches and things down here. And, I mean, the number of cattle, we have large ranches in area that we live in. So we've seen it. We've grown up around it. I mean, my father had cattle. We've had horses. We've always had these things. And you see it in a day-to-day basis. You know the trouble that it goes through when you deal with them day-to-day.
The largest source of freshwater pollution is cattle. The single biggest reason why we're cutting down the rainforest is to make room for more cattle. They're the second largest producers, natural producers of methane, ozone-depleting gas. They may be third, depending on how quickly the permafrost in the Arctic is outgassing methane. They're the largest source of desertification, the creation of deserts. I don't even have to begin to tell you about some of the diseases that come from cattle, rinderpest, clostridia, blackleg, anthrax, mad cow disease. The list goes on and on and on. So what we're dealing with here is a ticking time bomb. As more countries become affluent and are able to afford to raise and eat beef, we're going to further degrade the environment. We're going to open up the possibility for cattle-borne disease to race unchecked through the through the human population via the food chain. And my book is not only a book about this Gordian knot called the cattle mutilation mystery. It looks at this mystery in context, how we used to revere cattle thousands of years ago and sacrifice them to the gods. And now they're unceremoniously slain up to, as I mentioned before, 400 animals an hour in some of these super rendering plants. So this is a really complicated subject. I spent 17 months formulating the various databases that for the first time have been brought together, so we get a sense of how many cattle have been mutilated, especially in North America, and provide, you know, targeted sort of highlighted case histories for some of the more peculiar cases that have scientific evidence to back up the results of testing and that sort of thing. But I think it's important to really look at this in an overall sort of environmental Gaian context, because we may be dealing with the planets trying to warn us and spank us on one level.
It does seem that way. It does seem like it's bad karma circling back around to get on us at that point.
Yeah. The one thing that really impressed me early on was the realization, and nobody else has really ever mentioned this, but these unexplained livestock deaths are exclusively a Christian country phenomenon, number one. And number two, the only place where cattle are really sacred, besides some Maasai and the newer cultures in Eastern Africa, I mean, they revere the cow. Cows are their life. But in terms of a huge, you know, billion people, the Indian subcontinent worships cows. They have nursing homes for them. Hindi women will wet nurse calves if they don't have mothers. A cow is allowed to do anything, go anywhere, and do anything it wants, basically. And those cows are Brahma cattle. They're the Indian form of bovines. Bovine, I think, indicus is the genus or whatever the scientific term would be. They're the humped cattle that have that are colored, you know, basically colored white, and they have the curving, upwards curving horns. Now, what always interested me was, you know, we have Brahma cows all over, anywhere cattle are raised, you're going to have strains of Brahma cows. And I tried my darndest to find a single mutilation report of a Brahma, and I have been unable to find a single case anywhere.
That's strange.
Of a Brahma cow. So, you know, we're talking, you know, there may be some really interesting cultural clues kind of burbling under the surface of this whole mystery.
So we're talking Herefords and Angus and Kianina and all these others, but no Brahmas.
No Brahmas. And generally a vast majority, 90, probably, I'd say 98%, if I had to guess, of cattle that are found in a mutilated condition or so-called, are hybrid cows. They're combinations of breeds. Very rarely do you have a pure strain of like a seed bull that's worth, you know, $30,000. There are cases, and I do highlight them in the book, but they're extremely rare. All these animals tend to be hybrids. And out of all the cases that I've looked at, only one case even mentioned the word Brahma because it was half Brahma. So, you know, I have to kind of equivocate a little bit here, but in terms of a purebred Brahma, I've never found a single case.
Was it a Brangus that you got in touch with?
I think it was, actually. It was a Brangus.
Yeah.
Real good bucking bulls.
Oh, yeah, they make great bucking bulls. I guess they're just hell to be studied. Yeah. You don't want to get down there and mess with them.
Well, yeah, if you're thinking about if you're going to try to abduct a cow and do some kind of test, you probably don't want to get one that's a bucking bull.
You want it to be slightly docile before you start messing with it.
Yeah, either that or use some ketamine or some sort of tranquilizer on it, which have been found in chemical tests of animals. We found barbiturates, mescaline, PCP, all sorts of tranks, anticoagulants. Quite a number of different drugs have been detected in examination of mutilated cows.
Wow. Now, is there any chance that there's more, like, is it more often bulls or steers or is it cows? Is there any difference there or is it just all across the board?
I would say the majority of them are female. Okay. And you don't see as many male animals, I think, and you don't see as many steers mutilated. It's generally young cow, hybrid cows that are the target of these perpetrators, for lack of a better term.
Well, it was funny because you were just brought up something that I was going to ask later on, but it was if you're finding known, I guess you could call them stimulants, you could call them downer, any kind of sedatives, anything like that in the animal, that lends you to believe that it's being done by human beings. It's being done by a terrestrial force.
It's more than
anything that, you know, you hear all the tales, and I know you know exactly what I'm talking about, of all these different tales of UFOs or of certain things coming in, you know.
They had no blood in them.
And
there's a lot of popular misconceptions out there. Very few cases feature unidentified lights or UFO-type reports. These are very rare if you compare them to, let's say, the number of helicopters that have been sighted in and around mutilation sites, or the number of cases where nothing is sighted. Those are the vast majority, where nobody hears a thing, the dogs don't bark, there are no clues left behind. It's if the animal was swooped up, taken somewhere, experimented on, and dropped back in a different part of the pasture to, you know, alleviate any accidental disclosure of crime scene evidence. So this is a very, very complicated scenario. What is really, I think, important is to, you mentioned a couple of popular misconceptions. One of the things that my research associate and mentor, David Perkins, who's been involved in this for 40 years, is the first person Linda Howe called when she wanted to find out about cattle mutilation. She called my dear friend, David Perkins. He and I are co-writing an analytical book that's going to look at stalking the herd and throw the mud. Stalking the herd throws the mud against the wall, and the follow-up book will be analyzing what sticks. And one of the things he discovered early on was there's an interesting evidence chain within the disclosure of these cases, how these stories and newspaper reports and police reports filter out into the culture, and how various theories actually became formulated, grew legs, and then gained a foothold within the culture, whether it's Satanists, whether it's the government, whether it's ETs, whether it's some sort of you know, preternatural, ancient predator, for instance. There's various theories out there. And what we've done in this book is tracked back to the beginning point of where all these various theories were first developed and how they spread through the culture. They're memes, basically. They're memes in culture. And you can backtrack them and you can figure out when they started. Now, you mentioned all these substances found in cattle. How about the cattle that have been shot with firearms, then mutilated? You don't hear Linda Howe talking about those, and there's a lot of them.
Yeah, nobody brings that part.
Yeah, no,
up.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Since when do aliens fire small lead projectiles at subsonic speed?
Yeah. Well, and you hear, too, of course, I know it plays into some of the extraterrestrial, but they've even found remains of the cattle in the trees. So you know that they were picked up.
Well, that's very hard. You know, there's a lot of stories, but I've really had a hard time backing up any of those stories with photographic evidence, with hard facts. We have had some cases where cattle have been found 2 miles away from where they should be on a rancher's porch. One case was found inside an abandoned adobe shack, and even if the animal had been alive, it couldn't have walked through the door. So there are some real high strange cases. We have cases where has been mutilated inside the womb. Yep. Check that one out.
There's no explanation for that. That's not trying to wrap your head around.
Come
on.
There's got to be some explanation.
Well, and I've also heard you discuss, too, the fact that you've visually yourself inspected the carcass and could tell where it looks like one person had started the incision and maybe was not quite as good as the guy maybe showing him, and the guy showing him took over to finish the job.
Yeah, that gets into the whole idea of red herring cases. The cases that are the highest strange and the most fantastic and peculiar and scary, for that matter, especially for the rancher, those tend to be the cases at the beginning of a wave. And then there seem to be a response number of cases that are done very professionally, maybe don't have the high strange elements, but are very well done and slick. And then as soon as the media gets involved, then every dead cow out there is mutilated, and all these amateurs running around looking at things they don't understand. Oh, that cow was drained of blood. I don't know how many times I heard that. And I'd go out there in the field with my brother after the investigation was over, and we'd flip the cow over and show him where all the where all the fluids are, which pool up in the body, you know, cavity.
Always in the lowest spot.
If an animal is mutilated after it's dead, the blood isn't pumping, you have reduced blood pressure, you're not going to have bleeding wounds. There's so many misconceptions about this, and I'm not even a veterinary pathologist. I'm just an amateur here, and I can tell you right now that even veterinarians who are involved with keeping animals alive and healthy aren't up to speed on some of the pathology and, you know, looking at necrotic flesh and determining why, how the animal died, how, and how it was disfigured.
Yeah, that's not something I guess they get called on a daily basis, really. They're made there just to make sure that the animal's still alive and kicking.
Exactly.
And it seems the parts that go missing are very strange, too, because I've seen predation on wildlife. And, you know, I've been on places where, been on a whitetail hunt, somebody shoot a deer and maybe not find it that night. Look and look and look and not find it. Come back the next morning. Early in the morning, you get out there, you track it, you end up finding it, and there will be literally nothing left.
Torn apart.
But, yeah, just like some bones, a little bit of hide. I mean, I've seen whitetail
tufts of
clean.
Hair.
Yeah, picked clean. We're not talking about predation like that, folks. We're talking about, like, exact pieces reached in and taken out.
Yeah, to a degree of precision that is really impressive in some cases. You know, the book is filled with, you know, documentation that talks about, you know, necropsies done on animals by vets and by, in some cases, by pathologists. And they're scratching their head going, I'm a really good surgeon. I don't know how the heck who could have done this portable, you know, with no electricity, no lights, out in the middle of a field, trying to be quiet, you know, even in a well-lit laboratory with assistants and, you know, sophisticated techniques, they have a hard time duplicating some of the incisional evidence that's left behind. So we do have a number of very, very compelling cases in the book that have, you know, quite a bit of documentation to support the high strange element. My favorite, of course, is the Sherman Ranch case up in Utah in 96, where the rancher and his wife were out checking calves and mamas. And they go out in the pasture in the morning, you know, it's broad daylight. They check a cow and her calf and you know, tag it and, you know, tag its ear and go on to the next, you know, cow and calf, you know, a few hundred yards, 300-400 yards in the same pasture. And they work on that calf. And when they come back, the calf they had just done, you know, literally minutes before is mutilated, torn apart without a drop of blood, and then the pieces are set back in almost a ritualistic fashion. There are some really well-documented high strange cases. Now, in that particular case, a veterinary pathologist was on site that afternoon along with a crack team of scientists who did a complete site analysis and workup on the actual animal. That was part of the National Institute for Discovery Sciences project on the Sherman Ranch in Utah.
Wow. Like cases like that is probably what gets it started with the whole extraterrestrial thing. Because, I mean, how do you explain that?
Yeah. How could it not?
Yeah. That's the first thing I would leap to, really, when I start thinking about this. There's no normal explanation for just a bunch of guys to come and do all that.
Well, you can't factor ETs out, but you sure as heck can't factor anything else out, too. This is a very complicated scenario. I've been saying for years, it appears there are multiple agendas overlapping there. Their agendas on top of one another. There seem to be various groups involved, some more high strange than others. One thing that has really stuck over the years is the idea that it's not so much the cow, it's where the cow is in the environment. It's almost like there's some sort of environmental monitoring program that's underway, whether they're monitoring downwind and downstream of where nuclear power plants are, where we enrich uranium, mine it, weaponize it. If you go downstream from these regions, generally that's where high incidence of mutilations occur. Also, the potential spread of mad cow disease in the food chain is one that doesn't get much airtime in the pop culture view of this whole mystery. There's quite a very intriguing body of evidence to suggest that one of the potential agendas is monitoring the spread of transmissible spongiform encephalopathy in the food chain. And that's a scary thought. I mean, there's up to 1,000, by one estimate, 1,000 different animals can be in a single fast food hamburger. So, you know, if you're accidentally folding nerve, you know, infected nerve tissue in there that has these misfolded proteins called prions in there, you know, all bets are off in terms of, you know, the viability and efficacy of processed beef protein.
And it's, you're right, and it's coming. We know that it's, we're, that mistake is bound to happen. Sooner or later, it's going to happen if it hasn't been happening quite a bit already.
Yeah, well, you know, I do go into a number of very disturbing what-if scenarios relating to that. So,
well, and I keep going back in my mind, of course, like I said, being an outdoorsman and hunting my whole life, I know how hard it is to field dress an animal in the dark or with a friend, even holding a flashlight, trying to do it on, say, a whitetail-sized animal or an elk-sized animal, too. I can't imagine doing something with precision in the dark, walking around, you know what I mean, as far as being a person, like if I was going to go out and do this, or say Kyle and I and you were all going to go out and do this. It's one thing, like, you know, you think about hearing the stories of people cow tipping. It's a whole nother thing to go out and go, I think I'm going to go over there. I'm going to dart this sucker. I'm going to get it down. I'm going to open it up. I'm going to try to suck the blood out of it. I'm going to take these few organs. And then that way it's going to be really creepy to the guy that has $1,200 tied up in this thing.
Yeah, that's not your average fraternity prank by any stretch.
And it's still a hanging offense here to steal horses and cattle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, in most parts of the West, all bets are off if you get busted.
Yeah, yeah. You'd be better off stealing a car than you would go on somebody's place and do that.
Oh, big time. Oh, absolutely. Well, again, that's what makes this mystery so compelling is there's so many disclaimers that have to go along with any particular theory. And David Perkins and I have often joked that it doesn't matter what theory you come up with. If he or I take the opposite side of the argument, we can slam dunk your theory back into the dustbin. For every theory you come up with, there's more than enough data to negate it. However, there's just enough data to make that particular theory possible and viable. So, you know, it's again, I hate to sound like a cliche, it's a Gordian knot that needs to be carefully unraveled. And we need to look at the cultural implications of this whole mystery, the effect that this has as it slowly permeates itself into culture, into cultural awareness on a conscious and even a collective unconscious level. We could be seeing, in some cases, a form of cultural stigmata, the instant manifestation of a warning to try to alert us about the severe environmental impact that cattle have not only on the environment but potentially on human health.
It very easily could be that. Yeah. And I think you're right, because it doesn't seem – there's a lot of these subjects in this little niche that we're all in that people want to label as black and white. And I don't think these subjects are that way. I don't think it's an either or. And this subject definitely isn't an either or.
Absolutely.
It is. There's way too, like you said, there's way too many things that the minute you think you have a theory, yeah, you may have a theory on one case, but this doesn't encompass everything. You can't totally wrap it in one wrapper and say that's what does
right,
it all.
I think that's what people are looking for. They want a conclusion. They want an absolute answer. And it's not one thing. It's a kaleidoscope from
Yeah, it doesn't work that way,
everything.
Guys. The book has I didn't count how many cases I actually highlighted in the book, but I would say there's at least 1,000 cases. And for every theory you want to come up with, you're gonna be seeing those cases unfold that give you that ammunition to think, wow, maybe this could be the rationale, or these could be the perpetrators, whatever. And then boom, as soon as you think you have a pattern,
you get to the next chapter.
Gives you the exact opposite.
Wow.
Now, Chris, what are some other animals besides just, say, cattle that you've actually studied that have been, you know, we were talking about javelina and things like that. There's actually been other animals that have been mutilated also.
Yeah, every pretty much warm-blooded animal in a Christian country. This is predominantly a Christian country phenomenon. You name it. I mean, there was a bison mutilated in the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo, right in some of the most secure, you know, space in America, right outside of the NORAD facility in Cheyenne Mountain. And then a few months later, they had a case right at their front door, of the door that goes into Cheyenne Mountain. We've had bison, deer, elk, swine, The earliest mutilation reports I can find were of sheep, hundreds of sheep being mutilated around London in 1606. Seals off the Orkney Islands were showing up headless with these strange, huge swaths of spiral incisions, taking away hide and blubber. I think almost 50 dolphins washed up in southern France, all with identical wounds. You know, the list goes on and on. I mean, goats, people, you know, there have been some tantalizing reports over the years of potential human mutilation cases, which I do go into to whatever depth you can. These are probably the most covered up cases in law enforcement and the most difficult to investigate. But this is not predominantly a cattle it's predominantly a cattle phenomenon, but that doesn't include all the other warm-blooded animals that are found.
And the fact that you keep reiterating that its majority is a Christian-based faith, the country that it's in, that's even stranger, really.
I'm surprised nobody realized that. For the last 40 years, nobody has realized that all these places that have reported mutilations since 1606, rather, they all are in Christian countries. I have no cases from Asia. I have no cases from India. I don't have any cases from Africa that have enough documentation to really state that they're classic mutilations. There's a lot of rustling and a lot of kind of folklore and urban legend type accounts, but none of them feature the actual classic mutilation. In other words, the soft tissue organs being excised, no crime scene evidence, no ripping and tearing of flesh, no bleeding, that sort of thing. So, you know, the fact that nobody has ever really realized this for all this time, it was like one of those eureka moments that I had. And it's like, whoa, these are all Christian countries.
But another thing that too, that just when you think, like you were talking about, we were talking about earlier, you think you've kind of got a theory nailed down. And then I always go back to the necrosis that you discussed. And there are certain cases that it's so far advanced that the animal could possibly still be warm, yet it's extremely advanced where it's just falling apart.
Yeah.
Or the fact
we've
that
had warm animals pulled apart when they tried to load it onto a truck.
Yeah, or the fact that it's 5 days old and it still hasn't even began to rot. It's just, it's like it's just been opened up.
Right, or there's a handful of very intriguing cases where even insects have died when they actually landed on, like flies, when they land on the carcass, they die. There's a number of those that are very perplexing and kind of made me a little bit reticent and very careful when I went out on some cases. In one instance, Jerry Valario, a New Mexico State Livestock Board inspector, went out on a case. He pulled the tarp back and some outgassing occurred. It may have been some sort of like a bug repellent that had been sprayed on the animal, but enough time had passed where it shouldn't have cooked, you know, underneath a tarp in the sun, and then literally forced him into retirement. He was hospitalized and had to retire.
Wow.
So, you know, if you see one of these cases, folks, especially you guys down in Texas,
Don't touch it.
Wear gloves, wear a respirator, be very, very, very careful.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I would have never thought that. I'd have been like, oh, there's one, you know, won't go around and prod around on it. But that's really not what you want to do.
Yeah.
Well, at the very least, if you're going to do that, be upwind.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I've also heard
have some Vicks VapoRub you can put under your nose. One of my most trusty tools in my mute bag.
Your go-to jar.
Oh, man. I tell you, there's very few things in life I detest more than investigating in the field a necrotic cow. Besides ignorance and stupidity, that would probably be my least favorite thing in my reality.
Well, and I remember you even talking about one of them where you actually got down and smelled it. And it, after days, it still smelled medicinal is the word that you used.
Well, it was a very faint kind of it's almost like a disinfectant sort of smell, but with a little bit of a deep kind of muskiness to it. And yeah, the calf was in a heated garage for 4 days, and you know, I literally put my nose, you know, as close as I could get without touching it, and I could not smell any cadaverine, which is the molecule that makes dead meat smell bad.
That is bizarre.
It's so strange. That is so completely strange and foreign, because it almost seems like, okay, the minute you think, all right, well, it's human beings. It's all right. We can label the government. We can say, oh, we've seen the choppers
or secret.
Yeah. And then you get this, you're like, well, did they inject it with something, or, you know, what the hell? Like, and even the advance, when you talk about the animal's still warm and then it just falls apart.
Like, yeah, that makes that, no and that sense happened to me. A veterinarian. I mean, it totally blew him away, and he wasn't going to call me. But when that happened, he called me.
Man, now you mentioned this happens predominantly or almost exclusively in Christian countries. Are there any regions that it's more popular than others? I mean, is it in all 50 states of the United States?
Is or it just only your
in
valley?
Or only in like really remote areas, or is it in well-populated areas too?
It's basically from the Mississippi River west to the Continental Divide is the main area in North America. In South America, you know, in 1999, 2000, we had a complete cessation of U.S. cases. It's like all of a sudden the ranchers woke up and they weren't delusional anymore, and they weren't reporting dead animals as mutilated. Which has always been, I think, the major slam dunk against debunkers saying it's all misidentified scavenger action. Well, how come cases go fast and furious for months and then all of a sudden, boom, you don't have any for 3 years? What, everybody wakes up and becomes non-delusional? So down in South America, you know, man, the cases ended here in 99, 2000, and then they had a tremendous outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the herds down there. And they really struggled to get you know, ahead of it. And when they finally inoculated all the cows and everybody felt that it was over, boom, the mutilation started. And for the next 2 years, from 2002 to 2004, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mutilation cases. And then they've continued all the way to the present day. And during that same time period, we have very, very few reports from anywhere else. It's almost like everybody said, hey, we've had enough fun in North America. Let's go visit our, you know, buddies south of the border. You know?
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
So, you know, there's enough evidence to suggest that there is a human element involved here. And they are monitoring cattle for whatever reason. Whether it's environmental, whether it's a health-related monitoring program. And the reason why they don't, you know, steal the cattle and do it is because then the cattle would be – it would be a crime. You know, people would file police reports and there'd be, you know, documentation and all that. If you leave it back there, you have plausible deniability. You can say, oh, it was just a, you know, unusual-looking or appearing scavenger action. So you always have that plausible deniability. If you leave the animal there, people say, well, why don't they get their own cows and rent their own pasture and, you know, raise their own beef? They do. And it shows some really good illustrations of how the EPA in an area, let's say down stream from a Superfund polluted site, they will raise animals and then take them into the lab, cut them up and analyze their tissues. And in one case, they found out that there was 600 times the amount of heavy metals in the animals. They should have been dead. And then when the scientist who was raising the animals said, well, you got to tell the ranchers around here about this. They said, no way. And he said, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to the press. And he became a whistleblower. So there are governmental organizations, whether it's the CDC, the NIH, the EPA, whomever, there are government organizations that raise cattle and other livestock for the purposes of analyzing tissues because of environmental concern.
And then you brought up a good point right there, too, is if they need to go out and get one in the field without letting anybody know that there's a possible danger, it's a lot easier just to go out and take one, do what you want to do to it, dump it back out there, and you already have all your information. You can kind of let the story grow that it's extraterrestrial or it's a Satanist cult or something like that. You want that. You want them to take that and go with it. And then this way, you still have your information. It didn't cost you anything.
Exactly. And you have plausible deniability.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. You're not on that trail anymore.
Yeah.
But here's another thing that nobody has really thought of over the years. Here's another element that I've uncovered. There are waves of cases that suggest that rich, large ranchers are using the mutilation mystery and phenomenon, perpetrating it on their neighbors as a way to drive small ranches out of business and maybe expand the big ranch.
Huh. Never heard of that.
I wouldn't put it past yeah. them. Human beings yeah, are some really creepy things. Never heard of that, have
you? Well, in the areas of high incidence in Colorado, especially parts of Kansas, the regions where were epicenters of mutilation activity in the 70s, 80% of the small ranchers that were in business back then are gone, and in their place are some of the largest concentrations of feedlot cattle on the planet.
Man.
And that makes perfect sense. That's another one of those that makes a lot more sense, the fact that they would use it to drive out any little competition because they want the rest of that land. They can go over there and hit them where it hurts.
The beef lobby is one of the most powerful lobbies in this country. It's the largest single sector of agriculture, but you will never hear how powerful they are unless you're Oprah stating on her show, "I'll never eat another hamburger again," and she instantly was slapped with a $2 billion lawsuit, which cost her $1 million to beat. So just for, you know, some of you listeners out there, I love beef. Yeah. I'm going to have a hamburger tonight.
That's right. That's the same thing with the Cattle Raisers Association down here.
Beef. I just love to tear it out.
Yeah, they don't realize that. I mean, that's the same thing here, the Cattle Raisers. The Southwest Cattle Raisers Association is a big, big thing here in the state.
So when you're in the classic cattle mute cases, I know there's a full gambit of things that happen, but is the most common practice they're removed, something's done and brought back, or are they rendered there on site?
It's really impossible for me to answer that with any certainty. It appears to me that the animal is experimented on or rendered unconscious or killed and then disfigured, if you will, elsewhere from where it's found.
Okay.
So whether it's taken there or whether it's found there and then brought to a different location, the animal does appear in many, many cases to have been left back in a place where it was not originally taken.
On that same note, Chris, for everybody that doesn't know, maybe there's somebody that hasn't been keeping up, what is the classic, you know, cattle mutilation or cattle disfigurement when it's reported? What's the, say, the standard, or if there is a close to that is actually taken from the cow? What is the normal things missing?
In this very rarefied realm of mutology, for lack of a better term, the classic mutilation is a cow that generally is missing its tongue from deep down in its throat. The tongue is removed in a surgical manner, and the mandible flesh on the upside of the animal, the mandible flesh around the jawbone, is taken away, and generally the jawbone is scoured clean of all evidence of flesh, hide, hair, anything. It's polished sometimes. I mean, like it's been in the sun for 30 years. That is the main thing that we look for a classic mute. Now, the second most predominant incision, if you will, or excision, would be the reproductive tract of a female cow. It's pulled out like a giant plug. It's like you reach in an 8-inch to 12-inch plug and pull the reproductive tract out with no bleeding. Oftentimes, the udder, the cow's bag is gone with a very clean incision. Sometimes an eye is gone, sometimes an ear, sometimes a patch of flesh, in some cases triangular, some cases square. No, not many coyotes that could do that. And that would be, you know, in one way of defining a classic mute, those would be the organs that are most often reported as missing. But the one thing that I looked in all the dozens and dozens of cases that I actually physically went out and checked out in the field, the one thing that I always did first is look for cut hair follicles. In other words, an animal, when it rips flesh, or a bird, when it pecks out parts of a body, or a coyote tears flesh away, or insects, when they start working their little nefarious magic, maggots and blowfly maggots and whatever, they don't cut the hair. And if you can go and look at an excision area and see, you know, an inch, 2-3 inches of cut hair, you know some sharp implement did that, and it wasn't the tearing and, you know, the ripping action of a scavenger or predator.
That's perfect. That is something that I never I've heard you talk about this and read some of the articles that you've been, you know, quoted in, and I've never would have thought that. That's one of those things that it's that would have blown right by me, and I never would have thought, go look.
Well, that to me is the ultimate litmus test for the reality of a high strange, you know, nature of a case, is if the hair is cut, like with a sharp knife, when you cut, you take a scalpel and you cut, try to cut the flesh off the jawbone of a cow, you're going to be cutting the hair follicles. Mm-hmm. You're not going in between them like ripping flesh would. You're going to be cutting the actual hair follicles. Now, coyotes have bad breath, but they can't, their breath can't cut hair follicles in a straight line.
Yeah, they're just not that, they're not that gifted yet. Give them some time, they're going to evolve, well, but they're not that gifted yet.
Right, and a predator is typically not just going to go for a piece of flesh random. They usually chew on the softest parts first, you know?
Well, wait, yeah, well, what's a coyote going to be tearing off the flesh off a jawbone? There's nothing there take back to the pups, you know?
Yeah. When you can get in there in the belly and everything else on them, that's usually all the soft parts is what always goes first.
But basically, yeah, but you can, you know, again, there are ways, especially for a veterinary pathologist, an expert. I am not an expert. I've really done my homework and become a fairly up-to-speed amateur, but a veterinary pathologist can tell fairly readily if an animal has had some sort of unusual cutting action performed on it. And the book is filled with examples of these tests being conducted by professionals and them scratching their heads going, somebody cut this thing. Plus, how about the case in Arkansas? I love it. They found mescaline in it. What, a coyote went out and started like chewing peyote buttons in Texas and then ran all the way to Arkansas and injected mescaline into the animal. What's up with that?
Well, yeah, that's how he ended up there. It was a chupacabra. He had the mescaline and he got to Arkansas because it sent him in that direction. And that's where he ended up injecting it when he bit him with those fangs they got. That's what did it.
Yeah. There was one theory that they were injecting them with PCP and the occultists were injecting animals with PCP and then taking the blood out and tripping out on it.
Isn't it much easier just to use the PCP?
You're like, you want another hit of PCP blood, bro?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, man, oh, man. I've never seen a psychedelic cow, but I mean, I'm not going to put it past it. Maybe the cows like that kind of stuff. I don't know.
Well, wait a minute. Where do you think magic mushrooms prefer to grow?
If you notice, it is always in dung for cattle or horses.
No, it's in cow dung. It's in ungulate dung.
Mm. That's how they got the mescaline in them.
Well, dimethyltryptamine is similar in some ways to mescaline chemically, but not even close, really.
That is, it's, there's, see, that just like that, there's, we laugh about it, but there's so many different fingers of all this stuff that there's no way to nail it down. Now, the book does an amazing job. My hat's off to you, sir, for the work you've
really
put in. I mean, it really is a
Thank
lifetime
you guys. I appreciate
of work.
That.
Well, tell people where they can find your book.
Well, Amazon will have it, at a cut rate, and it's doing pretty well there. But if you'd like a signed numbered copy, I'm only signing 1,000 books, and you can get a signed numbered copy from OurStrangePlanet.com. It is a strange planet. It's OurStrangePlanet.com. Or you can go to StockingTheHerd.com and just do a PayPal thing, and I'll go ahead and shoot you out a signed and numbered copy. And obviously, I am the co-host of theparacast.com, theparacast.com, one of our top paranormal shows out there. We have a ton of guests and real good ones. And you can go there and find out more about some of the work that I do. And, of course, you know, I have this is my fifth published book. The Mysterious Valley Trilogy, The Mysterious Valley, End of the Valley, Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, really kind of give you a blow-by-blow story of my investigative work in the 90s into 2000s. And there you go.
Well, Chris, we have thoroughly enjoyed it. We know you have been a busy, busy man with bouncing around. They've had you just running wild to do interviews. You have been really on top of this, so... We really appreciate
you for taking time to come on
and visit with us, man.
I appreciate the opportunity too. It's really important to get an objective, well thought out, you know, just insightful look at one of the most intriguing mysteries of our time. I do still consider this the greatest unsolved serial crime spree in history.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives Classic Rewind. Man, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview with Christopher O'Brien as much as we did. We had a lot of fun. Like I mentioned in the intro, be sure, if you're fascinated with this stuff or you would like to know more, you need to pick up some of his books. They're very, very cool. That's The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, and Stalking the Herd. I'll put links to it in the show notes if you want to check those out. That's awesome. If you like the show, not just this one, but Expanded Perspectives in general, and you want to help us out, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Also, one of the best ways to help us grow is to tell a friend, tell a relative, tell a coworker. This stuff seems silly and trivial, but it really does help the show. Don't forget, also, we are trying to grow our YouTube channel. So if you want to help us out, go over to YouTube, subscribe. Even if you don't plan on listening there, look, I totally understand it. There's much better platforms for that stuff. But you just subscribe anyways. It helps us out. It doesn't cost you anything. It's a win-win for everybody. And there is content over there that's not on the podcast. Shows like Cameron's Cryptid Classroom. We've restarted Unusual Encounters. And there's also some live streams on there that we did and that we will be doing again in the future. So that's really cool. Also, if you want to help the show, rate us and write us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. Doesn't matter which podcatcher you're using. And don't forget about Expanded Perspectives Elite. Your monthly donation is used to pay for monthly data storage, editing software, music, sound effects, audio recording equipment, cameras, research materials like books or videos or whatever restricted information that's locked behind a paywall. You help us produce the show with your monthly donation. And in return, you get access to all of our elite shows that we've ever done. It's over 230 episodes at this point. Each one of them. Sorry about that. My email or something's going off. Each one of those shows is just like Expanded Perspectives, same length, about an hour to an hour and a half long. So if you like Expanded Perspectives and you're wondering if you'll like Elite, I'm telling you now, you will. It's the exact same show, exact format. There's just no ads in there. We do curse a little bit, not much, but it's still the same stuff that you're always used to getting. Also, before we get out of here, if you have a story of your own that you would like to tell me and Cam or share with us and the listening audience, do not hesitate. You can email your story to expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Or if you feel like telling it on the air, you can call the show 888-393-2783. I hope everybody has a good week. Till next time, peace.